In 2003, I was deep in the throes of shooting the BBS documentary. I was a grizzled veteran by then. I'd gone to some pretty crazy places. I had been involved in long drives and finding people by calling over and over again. I'd gotten hung up on a lot. I had actually gotten a lot more phone calls completed than I thought, and there were always people sending me emails and saying that they had heard about the project and they were now ready to be interviewed. I was in Colorado doing a set of these interviews while staying at a friend's house, and I suddenly got a call that one of the people I'd been searching for years was available tomorrow. All I had to do was go 500 miles away. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It, a podcast about technology, history, and getting myself out of debt. Thanks to Daniel Boyd, Jeff Atwood, William Hearn, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. There are advantages to shooting a documentary alone. One of them is that you don't have anyone telling you you can't do something. One of the disadvantages is there's no one there to explain to you you can't do something. In Denver, staying with my friend Andrew, I got the word that somebody I'd been seeking for quite some time had become available. His name was David W. Terry, and he was the number two man on the PC Board project. PC Board was, in many ways, one of the most dominant commercial BBS packages of the late 1980s and early 1990s. It was, in many ways, a leader in its niche. It had everything: a slick interface, a way to expand it, and most importantly, a company that really seemed behind it, that would be there for you, along with the ability to use it for free and try it out. I'd run PC Board for a while, many people had, and roughly 10 years after the death of the company, there was still a strong urge to find out what had happened, what was involved, and the perspective from the side of the people who had been making PC Board. And I felt that, as best as I could, if I could get anyone involved with PC Board, it'd really add something to the documentary. The scope and span of the BBS documentary meant that I had sent out thousands, literally thousands of emails to people both known and unknown, people who had played a part in it and people I'd never heard of before, but who were willing to step forward and tell their story. Many of those speculative emails went out to email addresses that people had passed to me or that I had seen in an ad in a magazine, and most of them never came back. One person had contacted me, Steve Catmull. Steve had done work with PC Board as a very young employee, and most importantly, he knew how to get me in touch with David Terry. Let's put a little bit more detail about PC Board. It was a product of the Clark Development Corporation, run by Fred Clark, and he had a number of people underneath him. The name David Terry had shown up a lot back when I was a teenager. Remember, I'm running all of this stuff as a kid. I sort of understand what companies are. I think of them as faraway entities run by lots of people or by a machine. I either refuse to think that humans are behind it, or if I do, they tend to be hero figures. Fred Clark was one of them. David Terry was a name. Tom Jennings, Ward Christensen. I heard these names and I knew them, but I didn't know the people behind them. Clark Development Corporation seemed poised, along with Mustang Software, TBBS, Major BBS, to be an industry of discrete companies providing products, BBS products, where you would call them up and get supported just like you did with an operating system. Naturally, the introduction of the internet wiped all of that clean. But in those last few years, when things were starting to peak and money was entering into the process to the point that there were going to be IPOs and major sales, Clark Development Corporation really did seem like it was going to be one of the giants. When it fell apart fast. And along with it, Fred Clark disappeared. To this day, I do not know the fate of Fred Clark. He walked away from his company as it was falling apart. It got seized by the bank. He never showed up again. So it was natural for me to think I'd never find anyone else. I wasn't going to let David Terry showing up slip through my fingers. Steve had mailed me while I was in Denver, and I started to work out logistics. Here we get into the problem of United States geography. If you live in a part of the country and you understand it pretty well, distances have meanings. You hear about City A, City B, and in your mind, you think 3 hours, 2 hours, and you immediately know whether it's a good idea to drive between them. And then you make your plans. I was not in a region I understood. I was in Denver, and I found out David Terry would be available the next day in Utah. My production equipment at that time fit into a single bag, one I could check on an airplane, and of course fit into the trunk of a car. And I had a rental car with unlimited miles, and I started to try to figure out how realistic it was for me to interview David Terry the next day. It was about noon. I committed to it, and it was just not enough time to book a flight. There's two legitimate ways from Denver, Colorado to Salt Lake City, Utah. One of them takes you through the mountains. The other one takes you through Wyoming and then through the mountains. I chose Wyoming. Trying to figure out how long it would take me to get there, I ran the numbers, and it was 500 miles. 500 miles I would have to cover between these two locations to be able to get this interview. Steve told me David would be available after work the next day. I planned for that and assumed that I would have lots of slack in case I needed to pull over or otherwise take a rest on my way. So after telling Andrew I'd be gone for a little while, I loaded my things into the car and then went immediately to sleep. My theory was rest up, then get up in the middle of the night and start driving to Utah. I woke up around 8 p.m. and set off. One of the aspects of looking back on history is you forget what's missing. I had a cell phone, but the cell phone was a very basic one. It could only show text on its little LCD screen. I didn't have anything like an internet connection. I had a simple car and a way of telling people if I mailed them or called them where I was heading, but no way to keep up-to-the-moment tabs anywhere, and certainly not to look at any sort of GPS on my phone and be able to pass that to anybody. I was going alone. I fired due north from Denver until I got into Wyoming. One small bit of culture shock. When I finally got to Wyoming, there is a town called Laramie, and there is one major interstate going the length of Wyoming. It seems pretty obvious looking back, but at the time I was pretty shocked that there was a gate on the entrance to Laramie that could be moved forward as a way of saying, you're not going on the interstate today. It was possible during winter months that the one highway going east to west in Wyoming was impassable and wouldn't be able to be used by anyone. With the hubris of a 33-year-old, I started driving west. 500 miles is a long, long time, especially when you don't have anything to listen to or stream or podcast. All I had was myself and the nighttime. On one level, desolation is beautiful. You drive and you look around and there's no settlements, no signs, nothing that represents human interaction, just small hills and your highway fading in every direction into nothing. The occasional car comes the other way. Other than that, it's just the sound of the road and the sound of the wind. Occasionally, I would see some fences that I guess were attempts to stop tumbleweeds and other debris from going over the road, but that was it. This nighttime drive gave me lots of time to think about what I was doing. By that point, I'd done dozens of interviews for the BBS documentary, and I was saving the editing for the end. I wasn't filming somebody and then cutting up the interview. I wanted to do that all in one big swoop. I wouldn't do that now. There was lots of downtime in between interviews. I could have gotten a run on everything. There I was, thinking about what questions I would finally ask David Terry, and a little bit about what this project was and where I was going with it. I knew, even then, that it was going to be something special, and I was happy that I had set off on it. Turning my attention to the radio, I found out that almost nothing broadcast out there. There was nothing to listen to, except for one AM station, one singular human voice blasting over my speakers as I drove. And frankly, it was important for me to have something, some human noise going through the speakers so I wouldn't fall asleep. I'd fallen asleep driving before. As for how I've not crashed, well, mostly luck. You stop hearing the music on the radio, that means you're asleep, wake up now, and then keep driving. In this case, all I could hear were two voices. It was a caller and a DJ, and they were arguing politics, but they weren't really discussing them in any coherent fashion. They were basically yelling at each other. I forgot exactly what hot-button topic they were discussing, but they wouldn't stop yelling. They wouldn't stop declaring things one way or another, and after a while, it started to feel, and probably was, like an act. Two people putting on a radio drama just to pass the time, which meant it was perfect for my kind of listening. It took me about 10 hours of driving to get to Utah, and the sun was coming up just as I was entering the mountains. Mountains are very interesting when you're driving across a basically flat plain. They start to rise up in the distance, very hazy, and as time goes on, they're a little bit bigger than you expect. The Rockies are sharp and jutting, and as I got closer and closer, I realized I was going to have to go up them. My car held up pretty well, and frankly, as I drove through the mountains, I was just glad about the variety. For the company, Salt Lake City sits at the bottom of a valley. The valley of mountains around it have some houses, but mostly it's a grid pattern. And I drove in front of the Mother Church, the main Mormon church in Salt Lake City, and realized it was going to be at least 5 or 6 hours before I would have to go to David Terry. So I pulled over and went immediately to sleep. An hour or two later, there was a knocking at my window, and I groggily looked over and saw a policeman. I rolled down the window and looked at him, and he said, "Sir, if you sleep here, you're going to have to put money in the meter." I paid the innkeeper 50 cents and kept sleeping. As for the actual interview, well, if you took away the half day of driving, it was just another basic interview. It went on for about an hour. We conducted it in an office that was available after work, and I set everything up as well as I could, although looking back, the sound wasn't as good as it could be. One of the side effects of being my own production was that I had way too much to keep track of. In return for having the flexibility to do things like drive west, I didn't have someone to check the sound or the lighting, and I had to do that myself, along with asking the questions and moving the camera. It usually worked out fine, but it didn't always work out perfectly. The interview I conducted ended up needing a lot of post-processing to be able to make out what they were saying. But the result of that interview did make it into one of the episodes, the Make It Pay episode about the BBS industry. David's experience with Fred mirrored mine, that he didn't have any idea where Fred was. He assumed he had gone back to Texas, but he could be anywhere. Steve was a happy, impressed employee that was delighted to play a part that he did in BBS history. He thought that the folks he worked for were great, and he really enjoyed as a young kid being a part of this thriving startup of a company. In the interview, I don't sound too bad. I'm echoing in the background asking the questions, but I don't sound as messed up as I was sometimes, where I would literally fall asleep during the interviews from pushing myself too much. We covered a variety of subjects, including PC board and running a business, and BBS history in general. And after one tape, 1 hour, we were done. I thanked Steve, I thanked David, and off I went again. Driving back was no easier than driving there. I didn't have any way to listen to the interview I just conducted, and all I saw was more and more driving, extending into the night another 500 miles. Miracle of miracles, I did make it. Somewhere there, or driving back, I stopped the car and pulled over, just to experience the desolation firsthand, without any car sounds or listening to the radio, just me and nature, and knowing nothing was around. I took a picture, a panoramic picture, just to try to capture how it looked, but nothing really captures what it's like to know that you are truly alone. If I felt like giving myself a jolt, my mind might wander to what would happen if the car broke down or if I slid out of control. How long would it be before somebody would notice me? Where would the help come from? What help could they do? How much had I depended on this one simple rental car that I had picked up from some agency without any idea of its history or maintenance? The fact is, looking back on that 1,000-mile round trip, it reminds me how much of my life has been grabbing things and running into the abyss without any thought about returning or taking care of myself. How much of it has been amateurish risk assessment, trying to climb Mount Everest while packing a pair of socks and a candy bar. In the aggregate, it has worked out. What drove me was believing in myself and believing in whatever project I was involved in. I thought that the BBS documentary was not just a chance to make a film, to use my film degree finally in my 30s, but an actual crusade to rescue history that was going to disappear. I knew that the paper artifacts, the digital artifacts, they had a chance to survive. But the human story, the fact of these people and what they thought and gathering all of that, if I didn't do it, nobody was going to do it. I know logically that I am still young, but I feel old. I feel like I could not do a 1,000-mile round trip with any hope of getting it done alone. Maybe what I'm feeling is a need for a network that I didn't have in my 30s. That urge to reach out to other people and make connections and build a web stronger than my solitary existence. I didn't have people along with me for the very long, very, very solitary drive. Archive Team changed that. Everything about Archive Team is the opposite of how I did the BBS documentary. I work with folks who are smart and self-driven. I try to herd things here and there, but I don't necessarily have the final word. And as a result, things get done. People don't have to make the drive alone. They know they can reach out. All of us become stronger. What might seem like interdependence becomes strength. As it turns out, that is, and may end up being, the longest single round trip I ever took in my life. Destination, back to destination, 1,000 miles, 1 hour of footage, and memories that will never, ever leave me. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. Thanks to James Bekoyanu, Forrest Fuqua, Mark Pilgrim, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. It's summertime in New York. It's my favorite time of year in my favorite place in the world. It brings me back to when I was a teenager. It's the weather and the foliage and the driving around that just fills me with memories, all of them intertwined with technology and history. Maybe I'll talk a little bit more about that, but for now, I'll just say, take every day as you can, enjoy it, and please, always, take care of yourself.